Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The bipartisan infrastructure deal in Congress could be hitting the skids. Plus, government employers start mandating COVID-19 vaccines for public workers. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, the WSJ columnist Bill McGurn and editorial writer Jason Willick. The word last week was that the final text of the Senate's bipartisan spending deal would be arriving Monday, possibly with a vote also on Monday. Well, here we are. Monday has come and gone. The two sides are starting to snipe at each other in the press. Bill, here's what an anonymous Republican source told Politico, that their Democratic counterparts were trying to, quote, reopen numerous issues that the bipartisan group had already agreed to. On the other side, there's an anonymous Democratic source who is accusing Mitt Romney of reneging on a water infrastructure deal. So, I mean, Bill, to your eye, is this real breakdown, or is this just the last minute jockeying before everybody joins hands again?
Well, I think it's both, Kyle, and I think that the bigger issue isn't even that. Obviously, each side wants to keep its own provisions and get the other side to concede on those provisions. So that's normal. And we always know that the first deadline is never the real deadline. You know, they come and go and so forth. I think that the real problem is structural, and it's something you've written about before. It's Nancy Pelosi. I mean, Nancy Pelosi is saying that she's not going to bring up the infrastructure vote until the Democrats get all the other spending. That, if that's true, what that means is it doesn't matter what they compromise in the infrastructure bill, they'll get it all in this other bill going for reconciliation. And she wants that locked down before she'll agree to vote, to hold a vote on a bill that presumably would have some Republican support. So if that happens, it sort of makes moot the entire Republican argument. I mean, as far as I understand it, the Republican argument for this deal is one that the public likes infrastructure, so it's a popular thing to spend on, and you don't want to look like an obstructionist. But I think the more substantive argument for the Republican infrastructure bill is that by taking infrastructure out of everything else, because infrastructure is popular, you make the rest of the spending a far more bitter thing to swallow, and they won't do it. I'm not sure of that risk. I mean, it looks to me that Democrats right now, the momentum is shifting to passing that whole thing. We'll see what Joe Manchin does, all the usual suspects. But I think the Republicans are in a very, very tough position here.
I have a couple quotes here just to underline the point that you were making, Bill. First is Nancy Pelosi over the weekend. I remember we had this long conversation, this news cycle, where Joe Biden had linked these two bills, the infrastructure bill and then this bigger reconciliation package. And then he backtracked and tried to say that they were unlinked, delinked. But then again, here's Nancy Pelosi over the weekend. She said, "I won't put it on the floor," meaning the infrastructure bill, "until we have the rest of the initiative," unquote. And then Jason, the argument from some Republicans, Rob Portman, for instance, has called the infrastructure stuff a sweetener. And so his thinking seems to be, if the infrastructure stuff passes in a bipartisan bill separately, that it makes it harder for the bigger reconciliation package to get through. And it was notable, there's a CNN reporter who had this quote from Joe Manchin, the moderate West Virginian, the man in the middle, and he said this: "I would say if the bipartisan infrastructure bill falls apart, everything falls apart," unquote. So, Jason, how do you evaluate the political incentives here?
Well, it's becoming kind of farcical, this question of whether the bills are linked or whether they're delinked, because at the bottom, it's about power. And, the Democrats control the Congress and want to pass as much as they can in these statements that the bills are linked or not ultimately don't really mean much. I think, you know, to be honest, I think President Biden was right when he accidentally said that they were linked and that, you know, he wasn't going to move forward with the infrastructure unless he got his so-called human infrastructure or, you know, spending blowout on healthcare and climate and all the rest. And that's what Nancy Pelosi is saying now. All she has to worry about is, you know, does saying this make Joe Manchin pull out and take away the 50th vote that's needed to pass, you know, the larger, the $3.5 trillion, welfare package, basically climate, healthcare, and all the rest. So, I mean, you know, I suspect that both of them are going to get through in some form. I think that the hope of blocking the larger package with infrastructure is probably, you know, I understand the calculus by Mr. Portman, which is that, you know, if we spend on infrastructure, then there's going to be less of an incentive to vote on some of these other things that the Democrats want to pass. But I don't think it's going to work. I ultimately think that Joe Manchin will go along with the larger bill as well. So I think everything's going to get through in one form or another because Democrats control the Congress, and that's the bottom line.
But at the very least, it seems to me there's a lesson here about counting chickens before they're hatched. I mean, it was almost 5 weeks ago now that Biden announced he had that press conference, I think in front of the White House. He said, we have a deal. But it turns out that translating that framework into legislative language has proved to be pretty difficult. That framework, as far as I can tell, is now pretty out of date. Republicans objected to the Biden plan to beef up the IRS as a way to get some more revenue to pay for it. It's hard to know what else, Bill, they're arguing about behind closed doors. But the Politico story that I cited describes deep disagreements over key policy areas like broadband, water funding, highways, public transit, and financing the agreement, unquote. And my thought else is left if that's what we're still disagreeing about.
Right. No, I agree with you. There are serious provisions, you know, in spending. But again, if you look at what are the Democrats after? I mean, they obviously want this spending. And Nancy Pelosi obviously thinks either she can get the whole thing without much of a compromise at all, because they have the votes in the Senate if all the Democrats hang together, and enough votes in the House if they do the same thing. She's calculating she can get them all, or failing that, blame it on the Republicans, use it as a campaign issue. But what she really wants to do, what she's really going for, her gamble is to get it all and hope to get the Republicans to compromise themselves to be part of the infrastructure deal. So that would make it a lot harder for Republicans to campaign against the Democratic spending, you know, in next year's congressional elections, and just make it hard for them to campaign a lot. Also harder to blame them if we're going to argue that all this spending is leading to the inflation that we're seeing. You know, if the Republicans are participating in that spending, that's going to be a less pure argument to make. So I think, you know, again, the politics is dominating this, and Mrs. Pelosi's going for broke. And, you know, I would have to say, I think the odds are on her side.
And I'd just add, Kyle, I mean, I think that the best thing, and Joe Biden's political calculus, is I can appear as a moderate, and at the same time, the more ideologically aggressive constituencies in my party can get what they want. And so for most of the public that's, you know, not paying super close attention to the details, passing both of these would sort of be an instantiation of that. You'd say, look, here's this bipartisan deal maker who got infrastructure done that both parties have wanted to get done for a long time. And meanwhile, yeah, they also passed something else, which is going to be, you know, a very substantial expansion of government, the $3.5 trillion second bill. But I think, you know, having both of those pass sort of fortifies sort of Joe Biden's promise to the Democrats, which is, I'm a bipartisan guy, and I'm also giving the left much of its agenda at the same time.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
the chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Well, let's talk about a couple of the details of this, the disagreements, at least as far as they are leaking out of this closed negotiation room. One of them is about mass transit. And Bill, there was a journal editorial on this that says mass transit usually gets about $13 billion in federal funds every year. There was about $70 billion thrown at it during the pandemic, making up for shortfalls as riders quit going on mass transit. So there's more spending a part of this bill, but then there's also a provision that's being argued for by Democrats, according to this reporting, to take highway funding, gas tax money, and take 20% of that and direct it towards mass transit. And Republicans are arguing against that. I mean, red states, rural states, generally less areas that have less mass transit funding in the first place. But also, I imagine that they don't want to set the precedent that 20% of the highway funds go towards mass transit projects.
Yeah, you're saying the Republicans don't want that precedent.
Right.
Right, because the Democrats, I think, do want that precedent. Look, in gen, I mean, there's a couple of things. Is one, Democrats, you know, as an ideology, the Democratic Party is, you know, part of the group that sees the automobile as the enemy, carbon enemy, all sorts of enemies, right? And they've always favored mass transit. But mass transit really isn't effective or profitable, has to be subsidized almost everywhere. It's impractical in many places, you know, except for New York, which is an island. It makes sense in New York that the car traffic is so bad and the mass transit system is so extensive. But in other cities, if you have 8%, say, people taking buses or trains, and you double it, you're still only at 16%. You know, we need more roads and things like that. So I think the Democrats start out with the predisposition against cars and for mass transit. And what they would like is to have gas taxes and stuff. And they would like the automobile to subsidize mass transit. Now, I think it makes sense, and I wish we had done this before. I think with private fees, I think it makes sense to make drivers pay for the roads they use, right? So instead of having like a car tax where you're taxed whether you keep your car in your garage, you're taxed if you use the roads, all sorts of things. I'm for all those things that make users pay for what they're using. But I'm not for making the automobile drivers pay for the mass transit. I think that's just a losing proposition. I don't think it's worked well elsewhere. And this just establishes a fund. And also it kind of takes from local authority, right? I would trust that the people in Chicago, as badly governed as they are, know better what their transit needs are than people in Washington. And so once these taxes go in, they're very, very hard to turn back. And so I think what they're looking for is a permanent source of funding. And the Republicans are right to draw the line here and oppose this 20%, because we're talking about something that would then exist in perpetuity in all likelihood.
I imagine another part of the Republican argument here is that a lot of these transit systems have deeper structural problems, backlogs of maintenance that need to be done, labor contracts that can't be negotiated, and throwing money at the problem is not going to solve those underlying issues. And on that point, Jason, another thing that caught my eye was there's apparently an argument about prevailing wage rules going on. So CNN cites a Republican source saying, Democrats are pushing for prevailing wage requirements for a number of priorities, such as broadband and cybersecurity. And I mean, that's interesting. I guess my argument would be that if the point of the broadband provisions in the infrastructure bill are to build up some broadband networks, then the bill ought to try to do that as efficiently as possible and then save an argument later about wage mandates or subsidies or whatever kind of rules you want to put on that. But I mean, maybe I'm wrong here, Jason. The point of a road bill is to build roads, not to lift up road workers.
Yeah, there's been, you know, some interesting work in the last few years. Patrick Collison, the CEO of Stripe, has talked about this. Some economists at George Mason have talked about this, of basically, why is it so expensive, much more expensive now, you know, to build another leg of the New York or the DC subway than it was a few decades ago? Great American projects like the Golden Gate Bridge were done at much lower cost than we could possibly expect today, and with much fewer delays. So, you know, there is an opportunity to think innovatively about that instead of just, accepting this higher cost and slower pace that we've come to expect. And you'd think that an infrastructure bill would be an opportunity to try out some of those things, see if we can, you know, do something about contracts or materials or regulations, whatever it is that is really the source of this, you know, much greater price per mile that we're now facing, and save the taxpayers some money. The other thing I would say about mass transit is it sort of shows how some of these fiscal questions end up being culture war questions, because you have a party polarization now where the Democrats are much more concentrated in cities, Republicans are much more concentrated in rural areas. So, you know, spending just sounds like, oh, it's populist, it's spending, it's something everyone can support. But where and how you're directing it, you know, goes to how people live and the structure of their neighborhoods and whether they want a dense or a less dense style of living. So, you know, we're seeing that come to the fore and making the infrastructure debate all the more polarized, because it's getting to, you know, how Americans live, and that correlates a lot with party identification.
Well, on Monday, former President Trump weighed in against this deal. His statement says, Senate Republicans are being absolutely savaged by Democrats on the so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill. And then his suggestion was this: don't do the infrastructure deal. Wait until after we get proper election results in 2022 or otherwise, and regain a strong negotiating stance. So, Bill, I mean, I guess two questions. How much do you think that Trump's influence will weigh here on the negotiators? And what do you make of his argument to wait until 2022 and then do an infrastructure deal then, when Republicans have a bit of a better hand?
Yeah, it's very interesting, because Trump was always friendly to infrastructure spending, right? As president, he wasn't sort of in the Republican camp that where I am, that's skeptical of spending, even if it is on roads and bridges. So he's always been sort of for it. I think he sees this as giving Nancy Pelosi a victory. It's an interesting question. I don't know whether his argument helps or hurt the case, because Mrs. Pelosi is also trying to campaign against Donald Trump. So maybe the fact that he's against it will solidify some of the Democrats that are wavering. I don't know. I mean, I think he's right in his analysis that it's a bad deal. I certainly think if there were a Republican Congress, we might get a better deal on infrastructure. I also think that if a Republican Congress, even if it were Republicans that came up with it and the spending, the Wall Street Journal would say it's too expensive, not efficient, and find a lot of problems with the infrastructure. You know, I think the model for looking at this is all those promised shovel-ready projects in 2009. Infrastructure is a very easy way to waste a lot of money. And you can look at almost any state, look at almost any project and the budget overruns and so forth, and you would be justified in your skepticism.
Also in the news, government agencies are beginning to issue COVID-19 vaccine mandates for their employees. The big one here was the Department of Veterans Affairs, which said on Monday it's going to require vaccines over the next 2 months for about 115,000 of its frontline healthcare workers. Here's what the VA Secretary Dennis McDonough said, quote, "I'm doing this because it's the best way to keep our veterans safe, full stop," unquote. There's also a statement by New York City Mayor de Blasio. Here's what he said: "The Delta variant is deadly and the city is taking it seriously. Today I'm announcing that every city government employee will be required to provide proof of vaccination or submit a weekly COVID test," unquote. Jason, what do you think of this development?
You know, it's hard to feel particularly strongly either way. I think it's basically fine. I think, you know, we have a strong public interest in slowing the spread of this virus, which is making everyone's life miserable and threatening more economic and social damage. There was a decision by a judge denying a preliminary injunction to students at Indiana University who didn't want to get vaccinated, or you know, were challenging some of the consequences for declining to take the vaccination. And you know, I don't want us to be in a situation we've, you know, some, it's been a, during COVID, we've suspended some of our liberties, you know, and gotten used to that. So I don't want us to have a mindset, well, you know, to say, well, this is an exception. We can compel vaccination, you know, because it's an emergency. It's been an emergency for too long. I think we should have normal rules, but I think even under our normal sort of rules and normal social contract, you know, the virus is a problem that the society has an interest in defeating. So I don't have a problem with employers compelling vaccination, or you know, as long as the government, I think, you know, it's more tricky for the government to compel it for people who don't work for them. But if the government is your employer, and especially if you're working in healthcare or in transportation or in something like that, I think we need to speed up the pace of vaccination. So it's hard for me to feel strongly about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need to make a distinction also between it being mandated for employees by a government that is employing them and by private businesses, which have much freer hand here. But this doubtless there's going to be a lot more litigation on this question, but this Indiana ruling, Bill, I thought was pretty interesting. So the judge says a couple things just in the opening. He says, first of all, there are exceptions. Students have choices here. They can apply for a religious exemption. They can apply for a medical exemption. They can apply for a medical deferral. They can take a semester off. They can attend university elsewhere, or they can attend university online. All of that if they don't want to take the vaccine. And then here he says, twice the United States Supreme Court has upheld state authority to compel reasonable vaccinations. The states don't have arbitrary power, but they have discretion to act reasonably in protecting the public's health. And Bill, surely there will be more court rulings on that in the months to come. But this is an interesting first salvo.
Yes, and I think the distinction that you made between public and private is the fundamental one. But even, it seems to me what the court's saying, even with public institutions have some rights. And look, you have to look at it this way. If you're a public institution, whether you're a hospital, whether you're a prison, you know, whether you're the Division of Motor Vehicles, they are all weighing how do they function amid this crisis, both to reduce their liability and to keep their staff safe and to keep the people that they come in contact with, you know, their consumers or whoever's using their services, to keep them safe as well. And I generally think that one of the problems we've seen over the years is that institutions have been deprived of the authority to take sensible steps to do that, even if you disagree. I think, as you say, it gets trickier when it's private universities and so forth. I don't think it should be tricky. I think they should have more leeway. And I'll give you an example. My daughter, her university, she just got her shot, and she got it largely not because we're calculating the risk to her very large. She's in a young group. I think the risks are very small, but the university doesn't require it of the students. But if you do not get the shot, then you have to wear masks all the time. You have to socially distance. And presumably there are events and activities where you will not be allowed to be a full participant if you do this. So they have a lot of incentives. They make it very difficult for you to go to college, be in your dorm. You know, I'm assuming if you're not vaccinated, you have to wear your mask indoors in the dorm, you know, even with your roommates and so forth. So the incentives are all in the other direction. And I think we would have been a lot better off if we let more people make their own decisions, more institutions make their decisions based on the science at the time and so forth, what they know to do it. So I think the court was right in the Indiana case. And I think, as you say, I think for private businesses, some of them may take steps that I regard as dumb or unnecessary, but maybe they're taking them because they have employees who are very worried about coming back. And I think the calculation really should be theirs.
And one last thought here, I guess, Jason, I agree with you that I'm much more skeptical of a generalized vaccine mandate that would be applied to the public. I'm skeptical that any state or city would go quite that far. But what we're talking about so far is people who are working in, you know, the NYPD reportedly has a vaccination rate of about 43%. There are some nursing homes where they're at 50% or less than that, the people that are working there. And I take your argument on board that these emergency rules have gone on a long time. In a lot of places, this no longer looks like an emergency. But in some states where vaccination rates are low, the Delta variant is really going up again. Some hospitals in Louisiana are starting to shut down elective surgeries again. And so I'm a little sympathetic to the idea that if you work in a hospital, a VA hospital in Louisiana, where cases are looking like that, I can understand the VA secretary's point there, that this still is kind of an emergency in those places.
Yeah. I mean, I think an employer has that right to say, you know, if you're not vaccinated, you can't come to work with a bunch of sick and vulnerable people, for sure. My point on the emergency thing was I just worry about us sort of creating exemptions to our usual principles and extending them in order to justify new rules. And I think at this point the virus is endemic. It's here. It's endemic. We can't if we're going to mandate or have new pressure on people to get vaccinations, we have to be able to justify those just because we think that they're the right thing to do, not because it's an extraordinary situation. Because if that's the case, maybe it's an extraordinary situation for 5 years and we're suspending our, so anyway, I think you can certainly justify it. I think it was remarkable how few public employees of New York City were vaccinated according to some of these numbers. I mean, you think of the unionized workforce of New York, as a, you know, it's certainly a blue-leaning constituency. And insofar as the culture warriors were trying to divide, you know, and finger point vaccines into Republicans versus Democrats, that was surprising that cohort specifically is behind on getting vaccinated. But, you know, that's just how it is. And I think that the government can surely tell, you know, employees that are working in prisons, that are working in hospitals, that are working with people to that they've got to get shots. So I think you know, maybe there will be some backlash, but I honestly think that as the Delta variant keeps going and going, we're going to see more and more update gradually, and I'm fairly optimistic that this won't be seen as an emergency for too much longer.
Thank you, Bill and Jason. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.